Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Like a real-life Hannibal Lecter, the psychopathic murderer from Thomas Harris's Silence of the Lambs, Charles Hatcher was cunning, sadistic, and totally remorseless. He was a man with no conscience. He killed 16 people, 3 of them children. Hatcher was also responsible for a different kind of tragedy, the conviction and imprisonment of an innocent man who was mercilessly hounded by the police, the prosecutor, and the community for a brutal murder that Hatcher himself committed. A nomadic Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde who manipulated the legal system with gruesome skill, Charles Hatcher was the embodiment of evil, the devil's emissary on earth. His nemesis was the lone FBI man in St. Joseph, Missouri, who risked his career to end Hatcher's reign of terror. Innocent Blood is the true story of Charles Hatcher and his life of crime, a powerful and blood-chilling glimpse into the darkness between sanity and madness. It also chronicles a justice system gone wrong. Throughout his criminal career, Hatcher was able to fool dozens of psychiatrists who repeatedly failed to identify him as a multiple murderer. Hatcher's astonishing skill was not just in his ability to murder and escape imprisonment. He became an expert at manipulating the criminal justice system overall. He outwitted police, prosecutors, psychiatrists, and judges in 12 cities and 8 states. Terry Gainey first covered this story as a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Later, he spent 4 years researching the material for this book, interviewing over 75 people and reviewing thousands of documents, court transcripts, prison files, police reports, and mental health records. What emerges is a fascinating and horrifying portrait of a mass murderer at large in America. The book that we're featuring this evening is Innocent Blood, a true story of obsession and serial murder, with my special guest, journalist and author, Terry Gainey. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Terry Gainey.
Thank you, Dan. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you very much. This is one incredible book. I'd have to say that. Incredible and perfect for this true murder. As we mentioned just initially, give us a little bit of your background, why you wanted to be involved in writing this Innocent Blood, how you were in a position to do that. Tell us a little bit about where you were and what you were doing that you were in this position to write this book.
I was a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I was covering state government in the capital of Missouri, Jefferson City. And Jefferson City is also the place where the Missouri State Penitentiary was located. And I became familiar with this story through the release of a prison inmate from the penitentiary by the name of Melvin Reynolds. Reynolds was an innocent man who was sentenced to life imprisonment for second-degree murder of a child in St. Joseph, Missouri. But it turns out he was innocent, and the true killer later admitted that he had committed this child murder. And this is Charles Hatcher, the serial killer, who becomes the focus of my book, because the murder that he committed in St. Joseph was not his only murder. And I began researching his life of crime throughout the country.
Now, let's talk about the Christian, Eric Christian murder that is attributed to, as you say, Melvin Reynolds. Let's talk about that crime itself, as you do, as you write in the book, May 26, 1978. And there's a babysitter named Karen Carter. Tell us about this.
Well, although Charles Hatcher's life of crime began many years earlier, I focused on the disappearance and murder of Eric Christian as a way of beginning the narrative, Dan. Eric Christian was a little blonde-haired five-year-old boy who disappeared at a playground on a shopping mall in St. Joseph shortly before Memorial Day in 1978. His babysitter, Karen Carter, was also employed at a major wood products company in St. Joe, and she was responsible essentially for watching the boss's son that day. And she had gone into a store to buy an American flag to display, and the little boy wanted to play on the slide outside. And while she went into the store, she left him alone for a few minutes, and when she came out of the store, he had disappeared. And this begins a story of a city in the grips of a terrible crime, the death of this little boy in a city of about 75,000 in those days. And the family is a well-known St. Joseph family. Many workers were employed at the wood products company that Eric's father was in charge of. So for 2 days, they search the area around the city, and finally the second day after he disappeared, they find his body, and it's a little confusing about how he actually died, but it was later determined that he was strangled. And a special task force is empowered to investigate this terrible murder of this little boy. The city is in grief, and the police are under the gun to solve this terrible crime. But the task force is unable to come up with the perpetrator. In fact, in the course of searching for the person who actually did it, they arrested or took into custody a janitor by the name of Harry Fox. Some police officers said there's no way Harry Fox could have done this crime because the body was found in a wooded terrain on a hillside that somebody would have to be pretty agile to get to. Harry Fox was an overweight, aged janitor who just couldn't begin to climb the hill where the boy's body was found. But nevertheless, they brought him in for questioning. And during the questioning, he went into convulsions and died. And it was a sign that the police were very aggressive in their tactics in trying to solve this murder, but they couldn't come up with the person who did it. Well, several months go by, and a new police chief comes in, a fellow by the name of Hayes. Chief Hayes is bound and determined to solve the crime, and the police begin to focus on a gay man, a well-known police character, a young man in St. Joseph by the name of Melvin Reynolds. And when they first brought Melvin in for questioning, he denied killing the boy, but he told an interviewer, "I'll say I did it if you want me to." He was very, his intellectual capacity was diminished. He was the type of person who wanted to please everybody. He had had a troubled background. And this is the person they begin focusing on as the man who had murdered little Eric Christian.
You write about a couple witnesses and also the people that come into play in terms of law enforcement and become major characters. You write about the incredible effort, the search, and also the use of hypnotism and the use of truth serum. Again, much different for people reading this today in today's forensic world, I guess, in reality. You talked about a person named Jeff Davey, and you talked about a Carl Simpson, and you talked about, of course, Detective Agent Holtzdegg from the FBI. So tell us a little bit about the two witnesses that I mentioned, Carl Simpson and Jeffrey Davey, and the police interaction with them and what they had to say to police.
Early in the investigation, the police had to determine the route that whoever abducted Eric from that shopping mall would have taken to get to the place where his body was finally discovered. And they walked the route and began questioning people who might have seen the perpetrator, the abductor, and the little boy. And they came across a couple of people who were witnesses and saw an elderly man leading a little boy by the hand. They were walking, not running, or he wasn't carrying the little boy. They were just walking. It might have been the scene of a grandfather walking his child, his grandson, along the street and then along some railroad tracks to the spot where Eric's body was finally discovered. And one of the people who saw them was Carl Simpson, who was getting off work. He saw them from his, not from his car, but from the parking lot where his car was parked. And another fellow by the name of Jeff Davey was doing some excavating. He was digging some dirt for a plumbing job. He was a plumber, and he needed some dirt to fill a hole, and he was digging it from a cliffside along the railroad tracks, and he saw a man with a little boy, and they believed that if anybody saw the murderer taking Eric Christian, it was probably Jeff Davey. So he gave a description to the police, and they brought in a hypnotist from Kansas to try to elicit more details from Jeff Davey's memory, and it was one of the more exotic efforts the police employed to try to solve this mysterious crime. They also used a behavioral expert from the FBI in Quantico, Virginia, who took all of the facts, Dan, of the case, the time of day, motives, opportunity, and all of the things that might help to determine the type of person who would do this crime. And they developed a behavioral sketch that they gave to the police in St. Joseph, Missouri, to come up with the type of person they should be looking for. Probably somebody working in menial jobs, probably somebody who was not very well educated. The fact that the person had to climb an embankment where the body was discovered would indicate that he was somewhat physically fairly adequate and rather muscular to get up this embankment where the body was found. And
right.
They also said that given the fact that this was a child abduction, there might be cases of similar abductions of children being taken away for sexual purposes, and that they should be looking for somebody, a man, who has been convicted or accused of similar crimes in nearby areas. So they came up with this sketch of a potential abductor, a potential perpetrator of the crime. And Joe Holtzlag was the FBI agent on the scene who tried to help the local police in figuring out this crime. He was in an advisory capacity because it wasn't considered to be a federal crime at the time. And he was among the members of the task force who were trying to discover who had murdered Eric Christian.
You write about this confession, despite reservations from some people, when you talked about Police Chief Hayes, and then the prosecutor Insko wasn't initially so convinced. Tell us what happens despite some inaccuracies, inconsistencies, and lack of detail sometimes in Melvin Reynolds' confession. What happens with that confession?
Well, Melvin is questioned 11 times by police officers who continually come to his house, pick him up, and bring him down to the police station and interrogate him. And in one case, they use a sodium amytal, a truth serum, in an attempt to discover what is in his head. And the thing about Melvin was that he wasn't as sharp as those investigators questioning him, and he gave them some stories about where he was that turned out not to be true. Melvin probably didn't know where he was on the day Eric Christian was abducted and murdered, and as a result, the police thought he might be, if he's giving them lies in their questioning, he might be the person who did it. So they kept coming back to him continually. But people who knew Melvin, including a police officer who had gone to school with one of Melvin's sisters, said he's not the type of character who would have done it, and he would say anything to any police officer trying to please them, just trying to get out of the questioning session. And a woman who was aware of where Melvin was on the day Eric was abducted, said she saw him not far from her house, and there was no way that he could have been in two places at once. So there were doubts among people in the community that Melvin was good for this crime, but eventually, under police questioning, he signed statements and gave details of the crime that convinced officers that he was the person who was behind it. The prosecutor, as you mentioned, Mike Insko, was at first doubtful, but the pressure was on to solve this crime. The police were under the gun to come up with whoever did it, and Melvin was caught in this trap that eventually found himself signing a statement that he had killed a little boy in the commission of a sexual act. So he's a victim of aggressive police tactics, and a town that wants to solve a crime, and somebody has to be good for it, and Melvin turned out to be the patsy that police feared to committing the crime.
You introduce a character, a public defender that's, I thought was surprising, was very, very experienced and is a major character in this story. His name's Doms. And he wanted to represent him and plead not guilty by reason of mental disease. tell us a little bit about this public defender, Doms, and his concern for Melvin Reynolds, and what did he do as a result?
Well, Doms was the local public defender, and he was overworked and underpaid, but he was interested in defending Melvin to the greatest extent possible. Dick Doms was formerly a judge in the Buchanan County court system, but he had been voted out of office, and he was looking for some kind of way to keep a job in the court system of Buchanan County and St. Joe, and so he became the public defender. And he knew the ins and outs of law enforcement in the community, and he was aware of how things took place, and he was convinced that Melvin was innocent, and he had done some preliminary work on the case and had identified witnesses who would have said Melvin does not match the description of a person seen leading the little boy away from the mall. People said, Simpson and Jeff Davies said he was an older man, heavy set, thick shoulders. That's the person the police should have been looking for. Melvin was skinny. He was underweight. He was kind of a meek, not aggressive, assertive kind of person. And Doms knew that he had been set up to this time. But the family of Melvin Reynolds believed he needed a high-powered defense attorney to stand up for Melvin in court in Buchanan County. So they hired a well-known defense lawyer from Kansas City. St. Joe, Missouri, was about an hour's drive from Kansas City, and they hired a fellow by the name of Lee Nation, who was a criminal defense lawyer in Kansas City. And Nation came in to represent Melvin, and it probably would have been better if they would have stuck with Doms, because Doms knew the community, as I said. He knew the background of the police. He knew what had transpired in the crime. And Nation came in as an outsider and didn't have the same skills that Doms did in representing the defendant before a jury in Buchanan County. And the trial really focused on the issue of Melvin's confession. Melvin had told police that he had taken the boy from the ball. He had done these things to him, and he did it. It was an accidental death, and the way it went down. And Nation was hoping to keep those statements that Melvin made out of the court record, and attempted to object during the trial that Melvin was giving statements that the police had led him to come to certain conclusions. The tape that they played for the jury was the third tape that had been made in a series of interviews in a session that had gone 11 hours, one of the questioning sessions. It was a marathon session that, by the end of which, Melvin was making statements on the tape that the police had sort of led him to say after having questioned him about the same facts in earlier interviews. So these were the statements that Nation hoped to keep out of the court trial. He was unsuccessful, and it was based on what was on those tapes that the jury convicted Melvin of murdering the Christian boy. Nation did not call any of the witnesses who had seen somebody of a different description leading Eric from the mall. And as a result, Melvin was convicted and was sentenced to life imprisonment in the Missouri State Penitentiary.
You talk about and bring the reader right into the life of Melvin Reynolds. As a result, he is told that he is likely, because of the charges that he's been convicted on, that he is in risk of being killed. But despite this, he goes into the general population. What happens in general population with Melvin Reynolds?
Well, Melvin was incarcerated in the meanest lockup in the state of Missouri, maybe one of the toughest places of prisons in the country, the Missouri State Penitentiary. It's closed now. But in those days, it was a terrible place of the conditions were horrible, the inmates were tough, and the guards and correctional officers in charge of the place were understaffed. And Melvin was subject to brutal sexual attacks. He was pushed off a garbage truck. He was working on the garbage detail, and he was hanging on the side, and he constantly had to deny that he had killed this little boy. But in the prison system, somebody who is convicted of doing the crimes that Melvin did or was accused of doing would be the lowest on the ladder, the lowest rung of the prison system, and he was always subject to brutality, even though he was always denying that he had committed these crimes. And he was told that, you know, if you go into the Missouri State Penitentiary with a record like yours, killing a little boy, it's likely that somebody's going to take revenge on you and you're going to be killed yourself. And that's what Melvin feared when he was in the Missouri State Penitentiary. And oftentimes he came close to being killed during these fights and gang rapes and things that took place. And it is in that section of the book that I switch to the character of Charles Hatcher, because he had been in that very same penitentiary many years earlier, and he had been the perpetrator of killing another young man in the institution, in the Missouri State Penitentiary.
Right. Now, you talk about that killing to compare what Melvin Reynolds was fearing and what could have been his fate, fortunately wasn't. Then you introduce Charles Ray Hatcher and his criminal career, stealing cars, the violence. Tell us a little bit, as you write, about his background growing up and how he came to this life of crime.
Well, Charles Hatcher had been born in 1929, and he grew up in an impoverished part of Missouri to a very poor family that had several other boys. He was the youngest. His father had spent time in the penitentiary on various charges, assault, stealing. He had an uncle who had also been in the Missouri State Penitentiary. His mother was an alcoholic, and Charles Hatcher just didn't have an upbringing that could lead him to a life of prosperity. He was poorly educated, even though he was a smart little boy, according to his grade school teachers. The people who remembered the Hatchers from going to school in those little communities north of St. Joe recalled about how poor they were and how their shoes, sometimes they didn't have shoes. And, of course, he was born at the time of the Depression. And he began getting in trouble in his teens and involved in things like stealing cars, being drunk on the job and getting into fights. And gradually, he became, crime just became part of his life. He frequently found himself in the Missouri State Penitentiary for crimes like stealing cars or attempted robbery. And he was in the penitentiary in the 1960s for an attack on a newspaper delivery boy in St. Joseph, Missouri. This was his first crime that seemed to indicate the darker aspects of his being. He had done property crimes in his earlier days, things like stealing cars and breaking into stores and attempted robbery. But later on in his life, he turned to crimes of violence. And he attempted to abduct a newspaper delivery boy off the streets of St. Joseph, Missouri. And the boy got away and was able to identify Charles Hatcher as the person who tried to abduct him. And he was sent to the Missouri State Penitentiary in the early 1960s. And it was then that we realized what kind of a mean person Charles Hatcher was, because while he was in the penitentiary, he stabbed another inmate, a young man by the name of Jerry Lee Therrington. Therrington, in his physical aspect, seemed to have the same kind of physique as Melvin Reynolds. He was a small person. He probably didn't belong in the Missouri State Penitentiary, but they found him stabbed on a loading dock. And the only person nearby was Charles Hatcher, and they put Hatcher in solitary confinement for 9 months trying to get him to admit that he had killed Therrington, but Hatcher never admitted it. There were no witnesses, and so eventually Hatcher was set free in 1969, even though he had killed somebody in the Missouri State Penitentiary. This is the man who we find out later is the serial killer responsible for Eric Christian's death, but that's a little bit beyond what we've talked about in the story so far.
You talk about in the early 60s as well, is that his manipulative nature is evident when he's dealing with psychiatrists. So you write about that authorities knew that he was responsible for Therrington's death in prison, but they couldn't prosecute, so they kept him in the segregation as long as possible. But also you write about that this is the beginning of him being able to manipulate psychiatrists to be able to avoid serious convictions.
He spent so much time in institutions from his younger years in the Missouri State Penitentiary and later in mental hospitals in California, Nebraska, all across the country, Iowa, that he was able to feed back to counselors and psychiatrists and psychologists the kind of answers that would convince them that he had some kind of a mental problem, that he wasn't really a career criminal, but that he had some kind of mental disease. And by this knack that he had for manipulating the people that were responsible for his custody into believing that he was mentally ill, he was able to avoid long prison sentences. And it was after he committed a crime in California that this behavior was really, really indicated by the way he was able to keep out of prison in California. In 1969, he abducted a little boy in San Francisco, and the police arrest him. There's a witness to the crime. The police arrest him, and boy probably would have been killed had police not shown up to interrupt the crime in progress. And they take him to the police station, and Hatcher breaks away and runs into a mirror, cuts himself, and the police immediately have to take him to a hospital for treatment. And for thereafter, he's in a mental health system rather than in the criminal justice system of California. And the book has a couple of chapters at this point. It deals with how, in those days, criminals were handled in places like the California Mental Hospital at Atascadero, where Hatcher spent years of treatment and tried to escape several times and managed to escape once, although was recaptured. And through all of this, the mental counselors and psychologists who interviewed him said that, well, he's probably committed this crime. He attempted to molest this child in San Francisco, but he cannot be prosecuted because he is insane. And he would go back and forth between the criminal justice system and the mental health system until finally somebody said, you know, this person cannot be released to society. A doctor, A.J. Russi, who interviewed Charles Hatcher, said, this report is to inform the judge that, in my opinion, this man is still a mentally disordered sex offender, has not recovered, and remains a danger to society, and should not be given a new opportunity to victimize others. So eventually, Hatcher is committed to a prison hospital in Vacaville, California, where he is gradually said to be improving and finally gains his release. And this is just a short time before Eric Christian is murdered.
You write as well that there's confusion in those days, too, in identifying Charles Hatcher by the name Charles Hatcher. And so you talk about the various alibis that this, or pardon me, aliases that he uses. At that time, they thought they had a person named Albert Price. Can you tell us a little bit about these aliases and how he was successful using them?
Charles Hatcher probably had a dozen names that he used over the years. It wasn't until somebody really spent some time putting it all together jurisdiction he was arrested in, and nobody ever took the time to track down who he really was. For a while, he went by Richard Clark in St. Joe, Missouri, even though many years earlier people knew him as Charles Hatcher. He had, I think, maybe half a dozen Social Security numbers. He was known in California as Albert Price, and that's the name he was finally convicted under and served time there under, even though his real name was Charles Hatcher. So, and it comes to play later on when he's arrested and prosecuted in Missouri, when they try to show that he was a career criminal and they tried to use the California example, they couldn't introduce it in court because they didn't have the wherewithal of showing that Albert Price in California was also the same man as Charles Hatcher in Missouri. So it's an example of how in those days we weren't, our police agencies and our courts weren't so interconnected with computers and the ability to quickly put together the background of an individual. Things, since Charles Hatcher committed all these crimes, the governments and the states have become more adept at identifying characters like him, and he wouldn't have been able to pull off the crimes today that he did back in those days. But in those days, our court systems and the police, they weren't as interconnected as they are today.
You talk about a Gilbert Martinez, and you say that's not his real name, but I mean Gilbert Martinez case. Again, a horrifying attack However, you talk about how this person, this boy, the family thought it not best for him to testify, and they moved to Mexico. How does it happen that he contacts somebody to finally go to trial? I mean, this is an amazing part. Who does he contact? Albert Price, a.k.a. Charles Hatcher, who does he contact to try to get this thing into criminal court after he was trying so hard to portray that he was insane?
Well, it becomes clear to Charles Hatcher that his ruse to use the mental health system to avoid prosecution is not going to work. It took a little while for the authorities to finally prosecute him in court, but he realized if he didn't go to court and get sentenced, he would be forever bound up in this system of being incarcerated without any eventual release date, as long as they considered him a mentally disordered sex offender. So he goes back to his lawyer and says, okay, I want to go to trial. And he is tried in California, in San Francisco, and is convicted just based on the police witnesses who encountered him in the process of attacking the little boy on a hill there in San Francisco. And the boy doesn't have to testify, but the police reports are enough to send Hatcher to prison. And it's in the prison setting that eventually he convinces his counselor that he's gaining control over his life, and he can eventually be released and released from prison in California, and he's placed on parole as long as he takes his medicine, that is his drugs that are going to control his urges. He'll be okay, but within a short period of time, he escapes parole and is on the loose across the country, and it is shortly thereafter that he's back in St. Joseph, where the Christian murder takes place.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the law enforcement looking at other cases later, but at this time you talk about Hatcher arrested in Omaha in September 4th, 1978. Tell us about what happens with authorities in Omaha, Nebraska, and Iowa.
Well, the behavioral sketch of the man who murdered Eric Christian said, within a few months of this case, the person who did this will be accused of similar cases in other jurisdictions. And within a few months of Eric Christian's murder in St. Joe, a couple of hundred miles north in Omaha, a man is arrested in attacks on homosexual men in the city of Omaha. And this man is using a different name now. His name is Richard Clark. And in hospital and mental facility in Omaha or Lincoln, Nebraska, or Bettendorf, Iowa, Charles Hatcher, under various names, is arrested in these kinds of attacks, attempting to abduct a boy from a mall in Bettendorf, Iowa, getting in a fight with a gay man on the street of Des Moines, Iowa. There's all of these cases, and Hatcher puts on this act that he is mentally impaired, and rather than going to jail, he gets put into a mental hospital where he'll stay for a month or two, but eventually be released. The most serious aspect of this kind of behavior, Dan, took place in Bettendorf, Iowa, where Hatcher is arrested after attempting to abduct a boy from in front of a grocery store and march him to the back of the store, claiming he is a security guard. Hatcher uses this ruse to get the boy to come with him, and you know that boy is headed for trouble in the grip of this terrible predator who has a history of these kinds of activities. But the boy is smart and realizes, well, wait a minute, he's not taking me to see my mom. He's taking me out into the woods here, and there's going to be trouble, and he breaks away. They call the police, and they arrest Hatcher, and he finds himself in the custody of the Bettendorf, Iowa Police Department, and immediately Hatcher puts on this act like he's crazy. He begins whimpering and acting like he doesn't understand what's being said to him. So rather than put him in jail, they take him to Mount Pleasant, Iowa, a mental hospital there where he spends a few months and eventually gains freedom rather than goes back to answer for attempting to abduct the boy in Bettendorf, Iowa. Once freed there, he's back in St. Joseph, Missouri, a few months later, where there is another child murder. Michelle Steele is murdered in 1982 in St. Joseph, Missouri. So Hatcher has essentially come full circle. In 1978, there was a little boy murdered in St. Joe. He has this series of crimes taking place in Nebraska, Iowa, and elsewhere. And then he comes back to St. Joe to commit this terrible murder of Michelle Steele, an 11-year-old girl who disappeared on her way to the dentist's office. Well, in between those two cases, the murder of Eric Christian and the murder of Michelle Steele, that four-year window of time during which Melvin Reynolds has been in the Missouri State Penitentiary for a crime he did not commit, Hatcher has read in a police magazine, a detective magazine, that Melvin Reynolds has been sentenced to prison for one of the crimes that Hatcher committed in St. Joe, Missouri. So Hatcher knows that the murder that he committed has resulted in the wrongful conviction of another man. Hatcher had this abiding distaste and anger towards the court system. Many years earlier, he had been in the Buchanan County Jail and had created some kind of a disturbance there after he had been arrested for one of his drunken disorderly crimes or some other assault. And he was handcuffed over a bar, over a rail, doubled over, and they left him that way for a day. And it was a brutal punishment for a brutal character. And it probably deepened the mean streak that already existed in Charles Hatcher. So he knew what it was like to be in jail in Missouri, in St. Joe, Missouri, in Buchanan County, and in the Missouri State Penitentiary. He knew what kind of things were happening to Melvin Reynolds, and he knew that Melvin Reynolds was an innocent person. So this time, when Michelle Steele is murdered in 1982 in St. Joseph, Missouri, the police are able to focus on the man who actually committed the crime, Charles Hatcher, although at this point he's using the name Richard Clark. Clark is bound over for trial, and while awaiting trial on the Michelle Steele murder, he sends a note out to the FBI agent in St. Joe, his name is Joe Holtzlag, and tells Holtzlag that he has something important that he wants to say. And this note is the beginning of the unraveling of this entire career of serial killings that Charles Hatcher has been responsible for. And the note is the first step towards freeing the innocent man, Melvin Reynolds, from the Missouri State Penitentiary.
You talk about the extraordinary exchange that this Holtz leg has with Charles Hatcher, but he also indicates that this isn't an altruistic thing to free Melvin Reynolds as much as to shame the prosecutor named Insko. And you also have this incredible exchanges that with Agent Holseg and Chief Hayes and with Insko, Prosecutor Insko as well. Tell us a little bit about how hard it is or how difficult it is for Holseg to convince Chief Hayes and Prosecutor Insko about what that Hatcher has already said and confessed to.
So Insko, the Buchanan County prosecutor, and Chief Hayes, the police chief in St. Joe, Missouri, were responsible chiefly for prosecuting Melvin Reynolds for the Eric Christian murder of 1978. And now here comes a man who says, hey, you've got the wrong person in jail, in prison for this crime. I'm the one who did it. And so what Hayes and Insko have to do is become man enough to admit that they made a terrible mistake. They overreacted. They got the wrong person, put an innocent man in jail. And here before them is a career criminal, Charles Hatcher, a man who fits the description of the man seen leaving the little boy from the shopping mall. And Insko at first disbelieves what Holtzlock has brought to him. He calls Hatcher a manipulator, a con artist. He's trying to just buzz up whatever is happening to try to avoid prosecution in the Michelle Steele murder. But over time, Holtzlog and another prosecuting attorney in Insko's office by the name of Pat Robb, convince Insko that, it's more likely that Charles Hatcher murdered Eric Christian in St. Joe in 1978, just as he did Michelle Steele 4 years later. Hayes, the police chief, refuses to believe it, and never did believe it, and attempts to get Holtzlog fired. He threatens to go to Washington, D.C., to FBI headquarters to get him pulled off the case. But Holtzlog had done enough of the spade work to realize on the early end of the Christian case that Melvin Reynolds is not near the suspect that Charles Hatcher is, and that this crime, the abduction of and murder of Eric Christian, is part and parcel of what Charles Hatcher has done throughout his life. And in the course of questioning Hatcher, they put in front of him his prover sheet. This is a sheet that details all the crimes that Hatcher has committed all across the country under his various aliases. And Hatcher finds the crime that took place in 1969 in St. Joe, the Gilbert Martinez abduction and attack, and says to the agent, a day before this or 2 days before this, I abducted and murdered a little boy in a town outside of San Francisco, the town of Antioch, California. And he provides some details of what the boy looked like, about his age. He was riding a bicycle. I left him. I strangled him beside a creek near Antioch, California. And he provides all of these details that Holtzlog notes down and contacts the FBI office in San Francisco, and they contact the police in Antioch, California, and sure enough, there's an unsolved child murder that took place there. A little boy named Eric Freeman had been playing tennis with a buddy of his, riding back home on their bicycles, a man in a car stops them and convinces Freeman to get in the car with him, and they never were able to solve the murder of Eric Freeman, whose body was found August 28, 1969, beside a creek. They're strangled there in Antioch. But that's the crime that Charles Hatcher admits to from way back when that had never been solved. So Holzlag knows that he has before him this man who calls himself Richard Clark, who has been doing this kind of criminal activity all across the country for years, and he's the man who killed Eric Christian. It's not Melvin Reynolds. And finally, Hatcher agrees to go into court and admit that he's the murderer of Eric Christian, and that's really the most dramatic turn that takes place in the book, that finally we've got the right man and Melvin Reynolds can be released from prison.
You include this incredible exchange between Hatcher and the judge needing to be fully convinced, because it isn't a slam dunk that he will accept. Explain what Hatcher really wanted in terms of sentence, and then the reality of what could be done in Missouri at that time and why, and the exchange between the judge and him.
Well, Hatcher had these mood swings, and at times he would be incarcerated and he would refuse to speak to anyone. Sometimes he would be in sort of a catatonic state. And there was a comparison between Hannibal Lecter, the fictional character in Silence of the Lambs, and Hatcher. There were people who tried to say that he's a lot like that kind of a manipulative personality that could convince people to be like a chameleon. He could change his appearance, change his demeanor, and seem very smart and intelligent one minute, conversational, and the next minute he would seem like a madman. At some times in his lucid moments in speaking with Holzlag, he would say, "Don't you know what has to be done to a person like me? You have to give me capital punishment. You have to take me off the face of the earth." He described himself as having an uncontrollable urge that builds and builds over a period of weeks until he has to kill someone. And he killed somebody we know in the Missouri State Penitentiary, stabbed him. We know he had strangled children in various places across the country. And Hatcher, at one point, says that he would like to get the death penalty. However, in the state of Missouri in 1978, when Eric Christian was murdered, the death penalty was not in effect for technical reasons about the way it was prosecuted and carried out. So even though he admitted before the judge, a judge who had seen him many years ago, by the way, in that earlier attempted abduction of the newsboy that I mentioned, Frank Connett, the judge who sentenced Melvin Reynolds for a crime he did not commit, the judge cannot sentence Hatcher to death because capital punishment does not exist. But the judge has to be convinced that Hatcher indeed murdered Eric Christian, and so he's trying to get Hatcher to give some details, and all Hatcher would say was, "I did it. I did it all by myself. I strangled Eric Christian. I don't know why I did it." And finally, the judge is convinced, and he sentences Hatcher to life imprisonment in the Missouri State Penitentiary. It's a high point for Hatcher in the sense that he's able to show the justice system in Buchanan County is not infallible, that it makes mistakes. He's able to put the courts and the judges and the prosecutors in a bad light. And that, in a sense, is a victory for Charles Hatcher. He gloats about it, writes letters to the newspaper saying sometimes the system makes a very bad mistake. He kind of telegraphs the fact that this whole case is going to blow up in St. Joe, Missouri, and when it does, there are going to be a lot of people who don't look so good, and that would include the police chief, that would include Mike Insko, the prosecutor. And so it's an attempt or an example of Hatcher manipulating the justice system to suit his own needs. In this case, makes a mockery of the justice system. But in fact, what Hatcher has done is he has freed an innocent man from prison. And what the book shows, that at least the way our court systems work and police systems work then, Dan, they were not infallible. Of course, they're not infallible today. But in those days, it was less likely that you could catch a man like Charles Hatcher. He was actually smarter than the system. He knew the system's weaknesses. He knew what buttons to push to get psychiatrists to decide he's not a criminal, he's mentally ill, and they put him in a hospital from which he could escape. That likelihood does not exist much today. Also, when Eric Christian was abducted, there was nothing in place that could mobilize the public like we can today with all the Amber Alerts and the systems that we have to immediately notify the public that a child is missing, and we have to be on the lookout for this child. So we have things in place now that would help capture or interrupt or stop the Charles Hatchers that might exist today.
You write about the surprise and, of course, elation that Melvin Reynolds experienced. How many years was Melvin Reynolds in prison before he was released? And just tell us a little bit of, as you write, the strange occurrence that was him being released.
Well, Melvin always insisted that he was innocent, and he was tried in 1979 and sentenced to the Missouri State Penitentiary, and it was not until 1983 that he's finally released, because Charles Hatcher has finally admitted that he's responsible for this crime. Melvin is not somebody who's going to sue the justice system, sue the courts for wrongful conviction. He's just happy that he's an introvert who's happy to have finally been freed from prison. And he's so happy that he's not been killed in prison like he was afraid he'd be killed in prison, as people have warned him. And he was happy to find his way back to St. Joe and lead what he could of a normal life. The police chief never got over the fact that Melvin was actually innocent and claimed until his dying days that Melvin was good for the murder of Eric Christian, even though Charles Hatcher was the one who had done it.
And Prosecutor Insko, he had to admit that he was wrong, which was big of him, and prosecute Hatcher, didn't he?
That's right. He prosecutes Hatcher for the murder of Michelle Steele. Many of the crimes that Hatcher had committed all across the country could not be introduced to the jury that convicted Hatcher of the murder of Michelle Steele. But the jury does convict him. I talked to some of the jurors afterwards, and they said that what convinced them of his guilt, even though there were no witnesses, was that he had changed his name between the time that police first questioned him and the time he was arrested. So they knew that he was a dark personality, and it came through during the trial. And so Hatcher was sentenced to life imprisonment again in the Missouri State Penitentiary, where he was later found hung in his cell shortly after he was convicted. He was convicted in September of 1984, and he was found hung in his cell in December of that same year.
What was Agent Holstig's take on all of this? Was he bitter at fellow law enforcement over his treatment and the ordeal he had to undergo just to be able to get justice for Mellon Reynolds?
Holtzlaw's career really is measured by this case, because leading up to it, he was a lawman who was respected in the community. Other policemen were friends of his, and Holtzlaw believed in sort of a black and white criminal justice system. But what this case taught him was that sometimes the police aren't looking for justice. Sometimes they're willing to let things slide to solve a case. And in this case, they didn't look closely enough at all the facts to realize that Mellon Reynolds was not a murderer. And the reaction from some of his friends in the police department to where, why don't you let this go and let well enough alone, convinced him that there are not people willing in the law enforcement community to take responsibility for mistakes that have been made. And from thereafter, his view of the system was more nuanced. It was not black and white, that things were not as straightforward, and he could not continue his work in St. Joseph, Missouri, and he asked for a reassignment. He moved to serve later assignments for the FBI in Hawaii and San Antonio, Texas. And he later retired in Texas as an FBI agent. So the FBI was proud of his performance, and he was commended for getting an innocent man out of prison. But among the law enforcement, some of the law enforcement community in St. Joseph, he was not held in high regard for the way he had acted in that case. So he lost some friends, and his attitude towards the legal community changed as a result.
Certainly. Now, this book, Innocent Blood, was originally published under, tell us the original title that this book was published, and tell us about this book in terms of compared to the original.
The book was first published by Lyle Stewart Publishing Company in hardback under the title of St. Joseph's Children, Two Children in St. Joseph, Missouri, had been murdered by Charles Hatcher, and that prompted that title, which was changed to Innocent Blood when St. Martin's Press produced the paperback about a year and a half after the publication of the hardback. A few years later, the paperback was republished as a trade paperback, and it retains the Innocent Blood title.
Right. I want to thank you very much, Terry, for coming on and talking about Innocent Blood, a true story of obsession and serial murder. It has been truly fascinating. Is there a Facebook page or website that we might fans might take a look for this book and more information?
Well, they can go to my Facebook page, www.terrygainey.com, to see how to get the book, or it is available on Amazon if somebody would Google Innocent Blood, A True Story of Obsession and Serial Murder. It's another way of getting a copy. It's available through Amazon. I was an investigative reporter for the Post-Dispatch for many years, and this was my most fascinating journey through facts and documents and interviews that's always stuck with me. I was able to use the Freedom of Information Act to get FBI files to help tell the story, as well as documents and reports from mental hospitals in California about Charles Hatcher that I think helped tell the story in a very dramatic way. So the reader can come away from it, they're understanding the mind as much as you can of a psychotic killer, and also see how the Justice Department had trouble dealing with it.
Yes, it truly is a glimpse into all of that and the horror of all the victims and searching for their loved ones and this incredible journey through the judicial system to finally get justice and put away Charles Hatcher. Again, I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about Innocent Blood, A True Story of Obsession and Serial Murder. Thank you very much, Terry Gainey. You have a great evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Good night.